Thank you, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. I guess I kind of want to introduce a little bit sort of where I come from as far as approaching this talk, because I've found that I have a lot more questions than answers, and that a lot of the things that I've been seeing going on are, it's not a very research, it's not a very data-heavy presentation I've been giving. It's more of a concept and kind of figuring out, let's see how this might fit in heading us some direction to be looking at cover crops and at soil health. So I have most of my background, most of my research has been involved with arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi and soil aggregation. I started that research when I was actually an undergrad. And so I've been able to spend many years taking a look at these fascinating organisms. And that's really what drives me, is the whole idea of what's happening below ground and how cover crops can kind of fit into that focus. So I have a few pictures from some places in the area that I was at. I'm originally from Minnesota, so my family's farm is not too far away from this area in Morris, Minnesota. And as you can see, you know, we've had relatively rich soils in the Midwest, but we're eroding our hilltops, and so we're losing a lot of our soil quality. And this is what happens in the fall. We do a lot of fall tillage. So you'll see that the topsoil running off of those hilltops over time. This was in Glasgow, Montana, and this was actually, this picture was on one side of the road, on the west side of the road, and this picture was on the top picture was on the east side of the road. So the bottom one's on the west side, the top one's on the east side of the road. And you can see a pretty substantial difference there in the way that the soil looks. And a lot of that is due to the amount of tillage that's done in the system, and a lot of that is also due to what's sort of happening in that system with having cover that's going to be on the surface of the soil. And that's where cover crops are going to be coming into. So this is mostly just a tilled, no-till type of comparison, but I think that that integrates well into some of the things we can look at with cover crops. Again, this is very close to my home, so again, very close to my heart, and this is due to some fall tillage that we're doing. You can see the erosion that's happening here. You get all of these gullies and rills that are being formed. And part of the problem with that is in the spring, the idea is in the upper Midwest is that we till in the fall so that our soils are black so that we can get out there faster, so they're going to warm up faster. But what ends up happening is you get a lot of this standing water that's going to sit here, and it's going to pool and sit where you're coming in the alleyways, where you're going to come in to the fields. So yeah, it may be dry up here on the top, and it may have warmed up because it was dark and rich, but you can't even get into the field because you've got standing water that's sitting there. And on top of that, in the ditches, you have the topsoil that's eroded and blown off. We get wind. In the area that I'm from, it's kind of famous for the number of wind towers that we have. We've got about 600 wind towers in a very small area. So we do get a lot of wind there, and all winter long you'll get this snow that'll blow off, and we get this formation of snert, this combination of snow and dirt. And again, that'll fill up the ditches, and that's the last thing to melt. You'd think that it would be one of the first things to melt because, again, it's got black topsoil on it. But the thing is that all of the salts that are in there and all of the organic matter that's in there is keeping that snow from melting. So even though it can absorb some heat, its melting point is much lower, so that it's very difficult for it to be able to melt. And so we're not being able to get that melting that you would expect to have. So again, that fills your ditches and you can't get into the field. So all of these are sort of issues that are happening as a result of the way that we're managing the system. The other thing that we're finding is, this was in North Dakota last year. This was in June, and this was actually the field. You can see this top picture is actually from right here that you can see. And what ends up happening is we had a lot of standing water. The snow would melt. The water can't infiltrate. It's going to stand on the surface. And right here we get a saline seep that's happening. So we get a lot of salinity that's occurring now in our fields because we've got the standing water that's sitting there, and that's going to wick the salts up. These are a lot of limestone soils, so we get the salts that are going to get wicked up, and they're going to sit on the surface. And so, you know, the solution to this is to go through and put in tile drainage. Well, if the water can't even get to where you've got your drainage in, what good does it really do to put in drainage in here? because one of the reasons that it can't do that is because they come out here with these big land rollers, because that's their other solution, is we're going to break up the crusting on the surface. So we're going to break up that soil structure, and when they break up that soil structure, they break up the aggregates that are in there. And those aggregates are really important for being able to create the porosity for the water to be able to get into the soil. And those aggregates are going to be driven, and I'm going to talk a lot about this, is because the formation of those aggregates and the stability of those aggregates is driven by microbial processes that are interlinked with having a living plant growing. So when you've got cover crops in the system, this is where this linkage comes in. If you've got cover crops in the system, they're able to feed this microbiology that's then able to form the aggregates and stabilize those aggregates so that then you can get better water infiltration. So you can get better stability of your soils. And so that you don't result in these types of things happening. It probably, you know, at first glance, it may take you a little bit to pick out the picture from 1920. The rest of them are from 2012. After the dirty 30s, we said that this wasn't going to happen again. Take a look. This is what's happening. This is how these systems are functioning because we're not managing those systems appropriately. We've done a lot for conservation tillage. We've done a lot with trying to get some different management systems going in there. But I think one of the things that we're missing is we're missing this understanding with what is required for the biology to be able to stimulate that soil formation that's necessary to reduce the amount of erosion that we've got, that's necessary to change this data. So you've got basically, again, we've gone through and we've had policies with conservation tillage and all of those types of things that have reduced the amount of topsoil erosion that we've had in the United States. But, you know, starting about 1992, we got here close to 2 billion tons of topsoil that we're losing on an annual basis in the U.S., and we've not really moved very much from there. So we've had almost 30 years of not going anywhere. Or 20 years of not going anywhere in the system. And so when you end up having this, what is going on? What are the things that we can change? What's happening within the system? So that was a lot of the questions that I was sort of asking myself. And one of the things that I kind of came to the conclusion of is that the root of the problem is the root of the solution. We need to have more plant roots. If you have this greater rooting density, if you have the plants that are putting exudates down in the ground that are feeding these microbes, if we can get 70% of the photosynthetically derived carbon to get into the rhizosphere, that be in the roots and the exudates coming off of there, what could we have in our soils? What is the potential of what could happen in this system? And so those are the things that sort of drove me to kind of ask these questions and look at what happened with our vascular mycorrhizal fungi. These fungi, again, they take carbon directly from the plant. It's a direct exchange in which these fungi will penetrate into the plant roots. They penetrate through the root cell walls and grow up to the plasma membrane, and they form these highly branched structures called arbuscules. Before there were actually trees and before there were multicellular plants, there was this relationship between algae and these fungi. And these fungi form these highly branched structures so they could go out into the aquatic systems, or in this case, out into soil, in modern plants, where they will go out into the soil and be able to absorb more nutrients. They're able to have a greater surface area to volume ratio. So if you look at this by comparison, the amount of carbon that goes into making this root as opposed to the amount of carbon that goes into making the fungal hyphae, you can get a greater level of efficiency, and that's what we want to get out of our systems, is we want to tap into the biology that can stimulate this greater level of efficiency to get these systems functioning at a much higher level. These organisms evolved over millions of years with these plants in order to be able to try and get this relationship going, to get this stimulation happening. They know how to do it. We just need to be able to figure out the ways to be able to get this to happen much more often. So they can go out there and they can obtain a huge amount of nutrients. A lot of the look at mycorrhizal fungi has been focused on phosphorus, but there's a lot that they can do with micronutrients as well as with nitrogen. They can help to absorb water. And they can help to manage this system in which it functions much more efficiently so that the nutrients that are absorbed and the nutrients that are available are delivered to the plant or delivered to other plants in the system. So you've got these systems where you've got these highly branched structures inside here, and this is basically just a laboratory procedure where we stain the roots looking for the presence of these fungi. And these highly branched structures are going to allow you, again, to have that greater level of efficiency to pick up those nutrients and this greater level of efficiency inside the roots where they can deliver those nutrients without any loss because it's happening inside the root cells rather than it happening outside in the soil where this, if you dropped it off, it's essentially like the milkman coming and delivering the milk to your door as opposed to you having to go out there to the grocery store to get it. And some of the milk that's in the grocery store doesn't get bought. But if the milk comes directly to the door, that milk's going to get used. And so those nutrients are going to get used. They're going to be brought right into the plant and be available to the plant. And then inside here, the fungus is going to take carbon. That's what it utilizes. Their bodies are, just like almost all life on planet Earth, is carbon-based. And it's all coming directly or indirectly from photosynthetically derived carbon. So the more that we can have a plant conducting photosynthesis, the more we can get organisms existing, whether you're talking about microscopic organisms or macroscopic organisms. We're all needing to have this carbon coming from the plant. So as I started to look at this and started to kind of ask all of these questions, trying to figure out, okay, what is it that we need to do to be able to get this relationship going? So, you know, essentially this would be, you know, sort of what the roots would look like in the soil. And again, you have all of this fungal hyphae that can go out here and be able to get nutrients that are in the soil. That's what the little end dots are for, and water that's in the soil as well. And because you do this much more efficiently, you don't lose as much water in the system either. And that's a big thing, I think, with when we're looking at cover crops in the system. I came from an area in North Dakota that was a semi-arid environment. And what we're finding is when we put cover crops into the system, we get greater levels of efficiency and we can get more plant production on the same or even less amounts of water. And why does that happen? You know, in our minds, we say, well, plants need water. You can't take away water from the plant. And I'm not going to say that you're not taking water away from the plant, but we're making the plant and the whole system function more efficiently so that we're actually using the water that's there as opposed to wasting the water that's there. Wasting the water trying to get those nutrients to flow towards the plant roots, trying to get that absorption from the soil environment. The plants have to give off exudates to try and attract the microbes that are there. If the microbes are further away from the plants, that's going to require more water to get exuded from the plant roots while they're trying to give off those exudates. The exudates carbon doesn't just come off of the plant. It doesn't just shed. These things need to be dissolved in water films. We talk about water absorption from the soil by plants, but we always focus on the fact that the plants are sucking the water out of the soil. The plants are also flushing water into the soil environment, and we never talk about that because we just don't think that it's actually happening or that it actually matters in the system. But the more that our systems are starved for nutrients and for microbes, the more water loss you're going to have in the system. So you've got these organisms that are able to supply a huge amount of the nitrogen and phosphorus. They actually work together with a number of different organisms in the soil. They have these phosphate-solubilizing bacteria that will colonize the fungal hyphae. And those organisms, again, they do it very efficiently because they're colonizing the fungal hyphae. So it's right there where they can produce the enzymes that are going to release the phosphate from the minerals that are in the soil. And then they'll release that phosphate, and because it's happening right next to the hyphae, it's very efficient at being able to, the fungi to be able to absorb that phosphorus. It comes into the fungal hyphae. It's transported through that hyphal network back into the plant roots, right inside the cells. Think of the levels of efficiency that exist there. We spend so much time, and I'm not trying to say we're wasting time, but we spend so much time talking about how we're engineering tools to get better fertilizer placement. This is the best fertilizer placement you could ever have in the system. And so if we maximize our ability to look at this, think of all of the things that we can do. Now, when it comes to cover crop systems, one of the things that also intrigued me was this whole idea of the fact that the fungal hyphae itself can fuse one network together with another network. So essentially what you're going to end up having, if you have two different types of plants that are there, the fungal hyphae can actually colonize the roots of both of those plants, or you could have one fungus that colonizes one plant and another fungus that colonizes another plant, and their networks can actually fuse together. So you have this incredible ability to be able to do nutrient sharing and to supply the plants with the nutrients they need on demand, rather than what we do in a lot of our conventional systems where we supply the nutrients the plant needs at certain times throughout the growing season, but not always at the times that the plants actually need them. And we do that because, you know, we don't really have the tools or the ability to be able to place the nutrients next to the plant when the plant needs them. So we do it at times when the plant can't absorb more than what the plant, you know, when it's the size of the plant that it is, it can't take in more than it can take. And so we're ending up losing a lot of the nutrients that we have in our soils. So one of the interesting things that I got really excited about is this whole idea of the fact that you can have a legume plant that would be in the soil, and that legume is going to be obviously associated with a rhizobium bacteria that's going to fix nitrogen. So you have nitrogen fixation that's happening. Nitrogen fixation for the bacteria is the same as nitrogen fixation as far as the amount of energy that it takes. It's the same as energy or nitrogen fixation that we do above ground. It's a very energy-intensive process. Part of what fuels the energy on a cellular level is kind of, sorry, taking you back a little bit to days in high school and in your undergrad, but bear with me, is you have this, inside the cells, you have the mitochondria, and that's the battery for the cell. And to charge the battery, you need the electron transport chain. The electrons that go into that electron transport chain come from the conversion of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, to ADP, adenosine diphosphate. So as a phosphate, as phosphate is ripped off of that molecule, the electrons that are released go into that electron transport chain and fire the battery, that mitochondria. And that's what allows this to happen. For nitrogen fixation, for one molecule of nitrogen to be fixed in this process, it requires 32 molecules of phosphate. So it's a huge energy-intensive process. And when you look at this and you think about that, you ripped off the electrons, so you took energy away from that phosphate that you pulled off. So it can't go back in and make ATP. You can't just shove that back in and say, all right, now we can recharge you. You have to have a new source of phosphate coming into the system. Through evolutionary processes, one of the things that happened with mycorrhizal fungi is the grass plants that are associated with mycorrhizal fungi have the ability to stimulate the fungus to actually pick up excess phosphate. They will normally do this anyway, but the grasses can have them do it at a much higher level. So they can absorb phosphate against a very strong gradient if the grasses tell them to do that. So what they will do is they will absorb excess phosphate because the grass told it to. That grass plant will then basically, and again, there's not all of this thought process that goes in there, but, you know, just kind of follow the story. So the grass basically is nitrogen starved. It has its phosphorus needs taken care of because it's associated with the mycorrhizal fungi, but it's nitrogen starved. So it's got to find a nitrogen source. It so turns out that you have this legume that's next to it that's associated with a bacteria that fixes nitrogen. So that legume has some excess nitrogen, so it says, okay, I'll sell you some nitrogen if you sell me some phosphorus because I got to feed my bacteria. This all happens through the fungal hyphal network because the fungi pick up the phosphate, they transfer it to the grass, they transfer some of it to the legume transfers some of that phosphorus to the bacteria fixes nitrogen, some of that nitrogen goes into the legume, some of it goes into the fungal hyphae so that it goes back and it pays the grass. The fungus takes carbon through this whole process, the bacteria takes carbon and phosphate through this whole process, and then the fungus takes some of that carbon and it goes out there into the soil and it pays the phosphate solubilizing bacteria that colonize its hyphae to get more phosphate. Do you think we can replicate this process very efficiently that these organisms do? So what we need to do is we need to figure out how to get this to happen at a much greater rate in our system. And again, how this can help us with utilizing water more efficiently. So when we're utilizing nutrients more efficiently, like I said, it's not the same as if we've got the nutrients, the nutrients having to flow towards the plant roots through water. This is a case in which the nutrients are flowing through the fungal hyphae, and it's all on a cellular level, so there's very little water loss in this process. So the other thing that happens with this is that you get, you know, sort of these enhancements that'll happen where you get this buildup of soil structure that happens as well when you've got these fungal hyphae that are there, and they help to form these soil aggregates in the system. So we can get greater efficiencies. This data here is from studies that we did in North Dakota where we got an increase in precipitation use efficiency of 36 to 41% when we had 3 to 4 year rotations that included long season crops. Most of our rotation we had, that was compared to a continuous spring wheat. So one of the things that I asked myself was I said, well, you know, you've got a plant growing there all the time, but you've got a short season plant versus a long season plant in the 3 to 4 year rotation, and you've got more diversity. So what is that stimulating on the biological level? What is the difference that's happening within this system? And then, you know, we can take a look at sort of the needs that the plants have. And we've got a lot of data out there that talk about the needs. And this was just, you know, some particular studies looking at the needs of corn. There's somewhere between 2,500 and 5,000 gallons per bushel that's said in various different papers out there in the literature that the corn needs for water to produce a bushel of grain. That's a huge difference. Why is that difference existing? Some people could say, well, it's genetics, but can genetics explain a twofold difference in the system? Are the people here using that bad of genetics in this system? Something else is going on. There's other drivers that are happening in this system that's allowing for some of this stuff to happen. This was a study that was done at the Rodale Institute. This is part of our farming systems trial. This has been in existence for over 30 years. And these are plots that are set up side by side. Rodale's research is primarily focused on organic agriculture, and in organic agriculture, they utilize cover crops as a tool for weed management and for fertility management. So these are our organic plots, and this is our conventional plots. Side by side, planted the same day, same amount of corn that were planted, but you can see that you get a very big difference in the ability to manage water under drought conditions. So this happened to be a drought year. And part of that is due to the higher level of percolation, but part of it is also due to the fact that we've got a much more efficient system that's happening. So if we look again at this whole idea of percolation and water being able to get into the soil, the other thing that these microbes do to try and be even more efficient is they will engineer their own habitat. They create this structure out there called soil aggregates. These are the pellets, and you can see here, this is actually from a farmer's field in North Dakota. This was in a cover crop mixture that was planted on July 7th. It was following a forage pea crop that was harvested on July 1st. This is in North Dakota, so, you know, it was an early season crop that he got. He got his forage pea crop out on July 1st. He planted this cover crop mixture. It was a seven-way mixture. He planted it on July 7th, I was out there collecting these roots on August 30th. You can see the huge amount of fungal hyphae that's extending out of those roots and the huge amount of collection and pre-formation of aggregates that's occurring around here. I rinsed these roots off, so these are aggregates that are fairly stable that are going to stick around there after the plant dies. So you've got this system, you've got this ability to have this aggregate formation in a relatively short period of time. These are aggregates that are formed on switchgrass plants in about 3 months. So again, you can have this incredible ability to form these aggregates. And what they do inside these aggregates is they create an environment in which they can process nutrients that are going to be in there. And it creates a habitat in which the fungal hyphae and the bacteria are going to be protected because you don't get larger organisms that can penetrate inside those aggregates. But one of the things that's really important in a system, so as you get better aggregate structure, the aggregates don't fall apart as easily. And why does that happen? We can get aggregates that'll be formed, but aggregates that may not stay together very easily. So this was also in North Dakota. These were plots that were set up. They're about, I would say, less than a half mile from each other. You've got a conventional till spring wheat fallow system, a no-till spring wheat winter wheat sunflower, and a moderately grazed pasture. WSA is a measurement of aggregate stability in the lab, but you can see from these pictures, these are just 1 to 2 millimeter aggregates that I separated out. I just added water. I squeezed water along the edge of the petri dish, so I didn't squeeze it over the aggregates. But you can see a tremendous difference in the stability of those aggregates. So even though we could get some aggregates that are formed, why are some stabilized and others not stabilized? This is kind of a collection of a bunch of different data. This is the stability of 1 to 2 millimeter aggregates from some different agricultural and range type soils. The different colors signify some different states that the data was collected from, and the symbols are different types of management treatments. But what ended up happening is that even within these sites here, this was in North Dakota, and these were all minimum till or no-till sites, I didn't get very good aggregate stability, but I did get it in the grassland systems that you've got there. So I started looking at aggregate structure, and one of the things that it kind of intrigued me to start asking when we look at our cover crops is this whole idea of carbon input and the primary and secondary inputs. Because the primary input would go into helping the plant grow, it would also go into feeding the biology and getting them to grow. But then what ends up happening is if we're in an annual production cycle, there's just not enough input of carbon to be able to form some of the biomolecules that can help to stabilize those aggregates. And when you put cover crops in the system, one of the things that it's done is it's able to provide that secondary flush of carbon that allows those microorganisms to then form those stabilizing molecules. In our annual crop production system, everything was involved in a rebuilding cycle on a continuous basis. And it wasn't into this creating and enhancing the building of those soil aggregates and creating more stability. So with that, I just kind of want to leave you. I love this quote because it basically tells me that I know nothing or that tells me that I know nothing more than what we knew in 500 or 400 BC. So thank you.
If you have questions, turn the microphone.
A question. Tell me a little bit about the people that sell mycorrhiza as a seed treatment or as an application.
Mm-hmm.
What that's going to do. Will that ever populate?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things that can happen with that, and there are people who go out there and sell inoculums. They can be very valuable in some systems, especially in systems, they were initially designed in systems where people used fumigants. So you basically were killing and you had essentially sterile soil. So you had to have an introduction of microorganisms, and these mycorrhizal fungi are one of the keystone microorganisms for plant health and disease prevention. So it fits very well into that system. In a lot of our agricultural systems, it may not have as much of a benefit to be able to. The cost-benefit ratio may not be high enough in many of those systems. These fungi can travel. They've done studies where they've seen the fungi travel actually from the coast of Africa to the coast of South America. So they can travel in and move through and recolonize a system. What we need to do is we need to create the systems that are going to enhance their populations to the highest degree and maintain that in the system. And if you're using crops, too, that are non-mycorrhizal in the system, creating shelter belts for the mycorrhizal fungi may be a good thing to be able to do. Or, again, making sure that you're not utilizing those in a rotation in which it's continuous non-mycorrhizal plants. But there are ways in which they can move in to the system. The other thing that could happen is you could get maybe some antagonistic relationships. These fungi are living for their own right. Just because they help the plant is just kind of beneficial to us. But they're just trying to get carbon. And if they're competing with each other, if you have an introduced species that isn't native to that environment and isn't well adapted to that environment, that could compete with a native species, and that might result in some antagonistic relationships. So there's a lot more we need to know.
Time for one more quick question. Yes, sir.
I didn't think anybody was going to ask a question, so I just want to tell you thank you. I think this is the best presentation I've heard here at the conference, and this is an area that needs a lot more exposure, at least in the state.
Thank you.
Maybe you have one. Well, Chris, I have a question then. Is this why we need to have polycultures with a grass and a legume, and is that why maybe infestation might go up in a polyculture?
I think that, yes. The question had to do with having polycultures in the system, and I think that having polycultures in the system is extremely advantageous. And if we're looking at, you know, even in our annual cropping systems, putting in companion crops or having understory crops can be very advantageous, and people do that oftentimes they include a legume in their grass plants that they're growing, and it's because they want that nitrogen fixation. But then you can see what maybe are some of the benefits below ground that we're not even paying a lot of attention to. So there's a lot of potential out there in these mixed culture systems. And that's something, you know, that we need to do a lot more work on, having a greater understanding of that. It's great within the cover crop systems to have these mixtures going on, but we need to have greater understanding, too, of how those mixtures might work together to have a stronger benefit.
All right. Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you.